Number 37, Calmar Incorporated, petitioner versus Cook Chemical Company. Mr. Lyon? Oh, yes. And number 43, Colgate Palm Olive Company, petitioner versus Cook Chemical Company.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case started as two declaratory judgment actions in the District Court for the Western District of Missouri. They were brought by Calmar, Inc. and by Colgate Palmolive Company against Cook Chemical Company. Cook Chemical Company was the assignee of U.S. patent number 2,870,943, which was originally issued to Baxter I. Scoggin, Jr. The declaratory judgment suit was brought after Cook had threatened these parties with an action for patent infringement, and the declaratory judgment actions sought a declaration that the patent in question was invalid and a declaration that it was not infringed by the device that Calmar was making. Calmar was a maker of plastic spraying devices. Colgate Palmolive was one of its customers. It purchased these devices and used them on insecticide bottles. There was then a counterclaim by Cook, as there frequently is in patent declaratory judgment suits, a counterclaim for infringement, and an injunction and damages were sought. The district court found that the patent was valid, found that it was infringed. Before passing on the question of damages, under Rule 54B, the district court certified that there was no reason for delay in entering a judgment on the issues of validity and infringement, and entered such a judgment, which is an appealable order. The Eighth Circuit, on appeals by Calmar and Colgate, affirmed the judgment of the Eighth Circuit. There were then petitions for certiorari presented to this court, urging the court to grant the petitions and to find the Scoggin patent invalid. And that is the question presented to the court this morning. We have here a picture of the device that is disclosed in Mr. Scoggin's patent. This is on page 381 of the record. The device is essentially a sprayer of the sort that you buy in supermarkets that comes mounted in a bottle of insecticide or the like. Here is the, actually this is the, yes, this is the assignee of the patent. This is Cook Chemical's product sitting in this bottle here. What this consists of is a pump which goes down into the bottle would be down here. The pump itself is not patented. The pump is an old pump. There's nothing new about the pump. What is new, supposedly, in the Scoggin patent is the idea of putting this cap over the pump and holding the pump down during shipment.
I didn't hear you. Putting the what?
Putting this cap.
Cap.
Here's a cap over the pump. Supposedly the new feature is putting that cap over the pump and effecting a seal within the cap.
Now,
that there was no cap at all?
Well, actually, about 20 years before, there was a device with a cap on it in the bottle. In the manufacture of insecticides during the 1950s, neither of the companies that were making plastic dispensers were making them with a cap that was a cap in place. However, about 20 years before, there was a comparable structure, which we will show in a few moments. Previously, the merchandising technique, if you will, had been to take the bottle of insecticide, have a plain cap on it, have a paper collar attached to that cap, and have a sprayer attached to that paper collar. And there were certain commercial problems with that. There are certain commercial problems with that. The sprayer supposedly would fall off and the like. So the idea that Scoggins is supposed to have come up with is to put the plunger into the bottle and put a cap on the bottle to hold the plunger down during shipment, so that when you bought the insecticide or whatever product, you bought it with the pump already in place.
This was for shipping and storage purposes, not for use by the consumer.
Well, in order for the consumer to use it, the consumer, of course, had to remove the cap. And
the function was to protect the business during its shipment and storage, is that it?
Yes. The device a little closer is this device here.
The white thing?
The white thing is the cap. It's a cap with a screw thread on the inside, and there is a little, I suppose the patent bar would call it a protuberance. There's a little thing inside here that effects a seal within the cap. Now, the reason why there had to be a seal within the cap, it's not a washer, it's just a part of the plastic cap. It's just the way the plastic cap is molded, so to speak. The reason why there had to be a seal was that in the pumps at this time, there was no way of preventing the fluid from flowing up through the pump and out of the nozzle of the sprayer during shipment. Scoggin didn't know of any way to stop that. So the way that he chose to prevent leakage was to put a seal inside his cap. He put that seal right here, up above the screw threads. Now, if you're going to have a cap sitting on top of a...
Even though he put a seal there, would something still come out of that orifice in the pump? And
something, would come out of the, something would come out of the hole in the pump here, and it could fill up in here.
But if the seal were perfect,
and there certainly was a question about that, if the seal were perfect, it would stop it from flowing out and soiling during shipment. Now, starting from scratch, if there had been no prior art whatsoever, we contend that it would be a very dubious proposition to hold that Scoggins' bottle cap put down over the plunger and affecting a seal at what appears to be one of the very obvious places to put a seal, above the screw threads, which is the same place where your seal exists in a garden hose coupling. Even without any prior art, we would suggest very strongly that that would be an obvious thing to do, that that would not be an invention, and that accordingly there would be no basis to issue Mr. Scoggin a patent.
You don't question that this is novel or has utility? You question only its quality of invention?
It's certainly useful. It had imperfections, but it was certainly useful. And the utility...
So the only issue goes to...
Goes to invention.
Invention or whatever it is, that
whatever
quality
the,
covered by Section 103.
Whatever is the standard. One might wonder if anyone had ever thought of this before, and actually the answer is yes. In 1938, there was a patent issued to a gentleman called Mr. Losey, and this figure appears on page 477 of the record. This patent has all the elements of the Scoggin patent. Here we have a plunger sitting in a bottle. Here we have a cap which is put down over the plunger and which holds the plunger down during shipment. Mr. Losey, like Mr. Scoggin, didn't know of how to seal down here inside the pump and to prevent the fluid from coming up and getting into the cap here. So he had to have a seal in the cap. And actually, there are two places where you could put the seal. You could put the seal below the threads, or you could put the seal up here above the threads. What Mr. Losey did was to put the seal down here below the threads, and as we've just seen, what Mr. Scoggin did was to put the seal up here above the threads. I think if you're talking about places where you might put a seal in a bottle cap of that sort, that exhausts the two possibilities. Now, when Mr. Scoggin first put in his patent application to the patent office, he had about 15 claims. Now, the function under the patent statute of the claims is to define the invention as to which the inventor claims a monopoly on issuance of the patent. The first 15 claims that he put in were really broad enough to make to describe the Losey device. They were in entirely broad terms, and they described the function of a pump with an overcap with a seal in an arrangement, a neutral arrangement, either like this or like his own. The patent office, to its credit, rejected that by citing the Losey patent against it. Then there were a few other actions back and forth, with the patent examiner writing to Mr. Scoggin thinking up progressively narrower and narrower claims, until finally the patent office issued him a patent when his claims had been narrowed down to describe the specific technique of his seal, that is, his placement of the seal up here, and the fact that he put a gap down there so that you could, thank you, so that you could screw the cap down, and before you got to the container cap itself, this seal here would catch, so to speak. And he put a gap in there so that that would happen. Essentially, that was what the... There is no evidence that the Losey device leaked, and in fact, there was evidence from one of the officials of the company that merchandised the Losey device that it was satisfactory. According to his recollection, this was a long time ago. It was in the late 30s, before the Second World War, but that was his testimony, and it was not...
record of the claims of the patent in suit.
The patent in suit starts at page 510, and the basic claim is the claim that appears denoted as number one on page 512. It's all one sentence, and it's about 350 words long, I believe.
Are all four claims of the patent in?
Claims one and two were the claims that were charged against our clients.
Arrangements do anything with the Losey arrangement? Did not do?
No, it did not, Your Honor. Now, there, as we say, there are really only two places in which Scoggin could have put the seal in the bottle cap: below the threads or above the threads. I don't know if any further demonstration is necessary to show that it was an obvious thing to put the seal above the threads, but we have found a few patents which disclose the idea of putting a fluid seal up above screw threads. The first one of these is a patent issued to a Mr. Mellon in 1952. Here we have an arrangement which is quite like Losey and quite like the ultimate Scoggin patent, except that what you have here is a cap that fits directly down on the bottle rather than on the underlying bottle cap. In other words, in this arrangement, you don't have the second bottle cap here that you have in the Scoggin and the Losey devices. But we cite this to show the positioning, the prior art in positioning a seal in an arrangement of this sort. Here we have the seal put up here above the screw threads in a hold-down cap that holds down a pump, which is exactly the same place and exactly the same technique that Mr. Scotland's patent teaches. Actually, as I mentioned before, the common garden hose, incidentally, the melon drawing is at page 457 of the record. The garden hose, I believe, uses the same technique with the washer inside. You would have a coupling with a screw thread, and up above the coupling you would have a rubber washer, so that when you plug the other element in, tighten them up, the end of the one half of the garden hose would fasten and make a seal in your washer up here. There are other examples besides the melon patent of the particular technique of positioning the seal where Mr. Scoggin positioned his. One rather interesting one is a patent is disclosed in the patent issue to a Mr. Livingstone. This was in 1955, and again a few years before Mr. Scoggin's patent was applied for. Mr. Livingstone was dealing with hydrofluoric acid. Apparently he was either an employee or on retainer or had some relationship with the company that had to deal with hydrofluoric acid, which is highly toxic. Now, this was dealt with in flasks or bottles that had to have pouring spouts on the top. This is a pouring spout. And the pouring spout can be, in this patent, can be put into the bottle itself. Here's the bottle. Through an arrangement which holds it. Now, what Livingstone's idea was to again take an overcap, a hold-down cap, and depress the pouring spout a bit, and then effect a seal up here in the very same place that Mr. Scoggin effected it, up above the screw threads that join the overcap to the housing of the pouring spout here. Now, what this, incidentally, what this was trying to achieve was as follows. The hydrofluoric acid would leak out of the pouring spout. There was no seal up here. And if you didn't have this arrangement here, which allowed it to flow back into the bottle, the fellow who opened up the cap would get the hydrofluoric acid on his hands. Now, this permitted it to flow back down into the bottle. There was a seal up here, which prevented it from getting out of the head of the arrangement here. This seal, I think, is in the same position and performs the same function that the seal in the Scoggin patent.
How much,
if
any, of all this prior art you discussed so far was before the examiner?
The Losey patent was before the examiner. That was the basis for his rejection of all the early claims of Scoggin. The Livingstone patent was not before the examiner. Mellon was before the examiner in the late stages. He did not refer to it in the early stages, but in the later stages of the examination he did. But Livingstone was not. The examiner never found Livingstone. Somewhat graphic way of showing what Scoggin did here and what Kalmar did at about the same time, though it's only a partial showing of what Kalmar was doing, is described by this card. Here we have a sprayer sitting in a bottle. This is an unpatented sprayer, the sort of sprayer that was known in the prior art. The two prior sprayers that did not have overcaps of these two manufacturers. Kalmar's S20 is shown here. The prior Cook sprayer is quite like it. The prior Cook sprayer is called the Bacan 1. This device here, the commercial device made under the Scoggin patent is called the Bacan 2. Bacan is a trade name. Chemical uses. The take a Livingstone-type cap with your screw threads and your seal up here, and if you build up the surface here in order to receive it, that is by putting the other element of the screw thread there and putting some element that will key into that, then what you produce equally is the device on which Scoggin got a patent and the device that Kalmar produced that was held to infringe. Actually, I think Kalmar later achieved a patent which was basically on the elements lower down in the bottle, to which I'll address myself in a moment. The prior art taught a better type seal than the one that Scoggin put in, though this is hardly dispositive. Scoggin had this simple pressure type seal, just a surface inside the bottle cap. Kalmar, like the Livingstone cap, had sort of a tongue and groove arrangement like this, such as what you have in high quality wood flooring and the like, a tongue and groove arrangement. Actually, what Kalmar did in the SS-40 that was important, and the SS-40 did come out after the Daycan II, but what Kalmar did in the SS-40 was to provide internal seals, that is, seals down in the bottom part of the pump and seals up inside here, inside the pump. And these seals prevent the fluid from getting into the bottle cap in the first place. And actually, that in turn is important because besides containing the fluid inside the bottle cap, there's a further question in this area. There's the question of what happens to the housewife when she opens the cap, and the fluid that's in the cap might come out under the Daycan arrangement. There's nothing that prevents it from getting up here into the cap. Under the Kalmar arrangement, it would not get into the cap. If there were any commercial problems here, and the respondent has talked about them rather than talking about the prior art, if there were any commercial problems here, they were solved by keeping the fluid inside the pump. Our contentions in this case are quite simple. Whichever way you phrase the standard, the Scoggin device is not an invention. Put in the terms of Section 103, the modification that Scoggin did of the prior art of the Losi patent simply consisted of an obvious modification, taking a sealing technique that was taught in a number of prior art patents, and in fact probably needed no teaching, and simply using that as a modification of the Losi device. The repositioning of the seal was obvious. It was not an invention. We suggest to the court that there are two principal fallacies that were committed by the Patent Office and by the lower courts here that have combined and created the necessity of this court's reviewing and reversing the judgment here. The first, of course, is the fallacy of the Patent Office in granting countless patents. Well, they can be counted. They're about 60 or 65,000 a year now, most of which cover trivial modifications of prior art devices, and a shocking number of which cover gadgets of the sort that is involved in the suit. The claims, as allowed by the Patent Office, frequently are very, very narrow. But what happens is that these patents are a license to sue. You can't bring a patent suit without a patent. Once these patents get into the courthouse, there are these attempts to broaden them and to refer to the commercial history of what went on. And that, I think, is the fallacy that the lower courts committed, which compounded the error that the Patent Office committed. The question, as far as the lower courts were concerned, and I have no quarrel with most of the language, they cite all the right cases and their quotations are accurate. But the again, it's a case of the difference between the letter and the spirit. The basic question that the lower courts decided really was which manufacturer of plastic sprayers for insecticides in the late 1950s was the first to reach the market with a sprayer that could be shipped in place. And Bacan, Cook Chemical, did come out a little bit before Calmar. The lower courts lost sight of what is the essential question, whether in terms of the prior art there was an invention, there was an advance that was not obvious, there was an advance that was not part of the everyday work of the engineer, whether working in plastics or working in whatever fields, whether there was something here that transcended the routine. That is, we suggest, the basic error that was committed by the lower court. We submit that it was an error of law and that this court is perfectly free to correct it.
Commercial aspects of this problem are irrelevant to the question of obvious or non-obvious.
They're not totally irrelevant. I think this court has not said they're totally irrelevant. This court has said they are a make-weight.
Why did the industry have to keep working so hard when they had the Losin device for so many years?
Well, the reason why Calmar was working was because they wanted to develop the internal sealing in this device. There are a lot of prior efforts that the respondent cites were unsuccessful on the part of Calmar, but all those efforts were not aimed in the direction of simply putting a cap over the plunger and holding the fluid inside the cap. They were
related to Scoggins' device. You told me earlier that the Losi device had worked just as effectively as Scoggins. He didn't add anything to the commercial value of the Losi device.
Right.
Did I correctly understand?
That's correct, sir.
Well, why'd they keep pressing after so hard? I don't quite understand.
Why didn't they use Losi there?
Yeah.
Because they were attempting to make the reason why Calmar did not was to, because they wanted to make a seal down below, inside the bottle, and not allow the fluid to get up into the cap. I suppose there were reasons of economy as to why Cook used its positioning of the seal, which of course again is an old positioning of the seal. In Losi you have to have a washer on top of the bottle cap. And in their device, even though at first it didn't work until they later adopted the seal, it was like the petitioners, in their device you could get by simply by molding the plastic. And as a result of that, they were able to bring out a device that, according to the record, cost about a penny a piece. But that, we claim, is the only difference.
Well, let me see. I guess Losi just wasn't used, is that it?
Losi was used in the late 30s and then wasn't used again.
And that's all. And meanwhile, they were using other things and the bottles leaked until they came up with this one.
Until they, in effect, rediscovered Losi. I don't know if he actually knew about the Losi patent or not. Mm-hmm. But by using something that was available in the common stock of prior inventions, if it was an invention even in 38, mm-hmm. but in the prior stock of knowledge, this problem was...
Losi was Scoggins was sort of like Leif Erikson. He Leif Erikson to Columbus.
I shan't get into that question, Your Honor. If Your Honor is pleased, we appreciate the opportunity and regret the necessity of coming before you this morning and telling you about a series of bottle caps. But for the reasons we have set forth, we believe that this exemplifies the situation both in the patent office and in some of the opinions of the lower courts.
Mr. Lyons, was there any, I think you're concluding before you do, was there any talk in the Eighth Circuit opinion in this case about the necessity of a new result?
No, I don't believe that, as I remember it, that
that didn't get into this
panel.
By
this panel of the Eighth Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
I think this may have been a little bit after after the Ram case, but it was one that the Eighth Circuit decided in favor of the patentee. It's an entirely different panel from the one in John Deere. Yes.
All of them?
I believe all three. There's no overlap. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Justice, may it please the court. I think if respondent's position were to be boiled down to a word, it would be that we consider this to be a key case, not from the standpoint of this invention being world-shaking or that the world could not have got along without it, but because in this case it is now possible for the court, in our opinion, to remove a substantial amount of confusion that has been going on for years in the lower courts. This court has the opportunity in this case to set some guidelines and some rules and some regulations that the lower court is looking for. They're needing help. They want help. I have compassion for the problem that they have in determining whether or not an invention is obvious or whether it is not obvious. It is our position that the Eighth Circuit in this case took the right approach. Certain legal doctrines were set forth that this court can adopt and can do so without having to change any laws or without having to dig up some new principle not heretofore heard of. What the Eighth Circuit did in this case was to first look at the statute, finding that statutorily there are three conditions for patentability. It must be new, it must be useful, and then under 103, it must not be obvious. But the Eighth Circuit did not stop there. As soon as it applied the statute, it went into a determination of what this court, the Supreme Court, has said in the past. And it said that in order to be patentable, an invention must meet high standards. A mention was made earlier this morning of whether or not the last sentence of 103 is of any consequence. And the question was raised as to whether or not 103 changed the law. The Eighth Circuit, I went back some 35 years and I find the Eighth Circuit has been applying exactly what 103 has said for more than 35 years. They cited a case of Pierce versus Mulford, which we set forth in our brief at pages 31 and 42, in which the language, almost identical language of 103, is used. Now, if there's any change in 103, over and above what has always been the law of this court, would perhaps be in the last sentence, and we can only say that maybe the Congress was intending to say, we don't like to hear the court say, flash of genius. Well, the irony of that is, the only reason this court ever used the word flash of genius was to make a point. This court has said over and over again, the standard must be high. They've used all kinds of language to make that point clear. And one way to do it is to say there must be a flash of genius. So Congress, apparently in the last sentence, had in mind that there shall be no more flash of genius. But be that as it may, that is not our argument in this case. We go along with the concept that there must be a high standard of invention. 103 merely says that the condition for patentability that has not before been in the statutory law is that it shall not be obvious to one skilled in the art. Now, how was the law applied in the Eighth Circuit? In this case, first of all, the Eighth Circuit found that the Scoggin invention was new. Now, that's not very difficult. The law is clear. Any eighth grade schoolboy could understand what you mean when you say that a device must be new as distinguished from something that is old. Number two, the Eighth Circuit followed 102 in determining that there was novelty, that there was utility. I'm sorry, 101 on utility. And the way they found out was to determine that there was widespread use, that there had been success, and there had been acceptance. Certainly, if there were no utility, those conditions would not have existed, and for that reason, the Eighth Circuit said the device was useful.
We'll recess now. Mr. Schmidt, you may continue your argument.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court. In a few moments, I shall enumerate and briefly discuss 18 reasons why the Eighth Circuit held this patent valid. But before doing so, I should like to first continue an attempt to clear up some of the confusion as to the law and how it was applied by the Eighth Circuit. The question was asked this morning whether or not the Eighth Circuit has ever interpreted 103. I do not recall the answer, but in my opinion, it has not. In the Blue versus Dempster case, which we cite, the 1960 case, at pages 41 and 42 of our brief, the Eighth Circuit said, in applying 35 U.S.C.A. 103, this court follows the standards of patentability set out by the United States Supreme Court in the NP case. And that's as far as the Eighth Circuit has gone. What the Eighth Circuit has done, and which we submit should be done by all of the circuits, is to first consider the law, the statutory law, determine whether or not the invention is new, determine whether or not it has utility, and then attempt to determine whether or not it was obvious to one skilled in the art. The problem and the difficulty is determining whether or not it is obvious. Each court is called upon to, within but a few hours, understand the principles of every art that might come before him. Whether it be chemical, electrical, or something simple, he must understand it and determine for himself whether or not it is obvious. I submit that this should not be the whim of the judge and how he happens to feel about the particular art that he is considering. I submit that there are ways to determine whether or not it is obvious. And these are the 18 points that I intend to discuss, the 18 guidelines, the 18 signposts. They are referred to many times as make weights. Our adversary in this case refers to them as something irrelevant to this case. We say that it is abundantly relevant. If it were not for that, if we were not to look at these 18 points, these 18 guideposts, then all we have is the statute which says it shall not be obvious, and we have the judge and the appellate court and this court having to determine for themselves whether or not it is obvious simply by listening to one bit of evidence where experts will say, yes, it was obvious, and another says, no, it was not obvious, and we get nowhere.
Can I ask you if your 18 points are set out in your brief at one place?
Yes, you are. They are scattered throughout the brief. I do not have them enumerated.
Well, I thought from your argument maybe you might have.
No. But I shall point this out, that in all 18 points except one, this court has passed on it and has said this is something to be looked at to be determined whether or not this invention should be held valid or invalid. One point I could not find any law on, although I suspect that it has come up before. Again, before going to those 18 points, I'd like to take up this question of fact or law, again, which seems to be a confusing thing. At the Eighth Circuit level, counsel, My opponent was asked the very same question, and I was asked the question, do we have facts questions or do we have law questions? Counsel said it's a question of mixed fact and law. I say that begs the issue. That doesn't tell us anything. Now let's go back to Goodyear Tire versus Rayovac, where this court in 1944 said that it must be a strong case before this court will set aside concurrent findings. A little bit later, in Graver versus Lindy in 1950, this court emphasized Rule 52A. To be sure, there was a dissent in the case, but later on in the A&P case, again, the question came up as to whether or not the concurrent two-court rule should apply. It was not necessary for this court in the A&P case to decide that one way or another, because the court said that there were no substantial dispute in findings, and therefore the A&P case stands for a principle of law which simply says that when you have a claim, when you have a combination claim that includes a new element, and that is all that is new, you should claim that element and not claim it as a new combination. We have no difficulty on combinations of old elements. Very simple. If you've got a number of old elements in the combination, the only question is whether or not that combination is new. The difficulty is when you find the invention to be only in one element and that element is new. And the court has said, you must claim that, otherwise you're overclaiming your invention. And the patent office says to us over and over again, you have an old and exhausted combination that you're claiming. If you think this is new, claim it.
What is yours?
In our case, we have a combination of old elements. There isn't a single element in the combination that is new. We have not claimed it. We cannot be accused of overclaiming. We have claimed only the combination. We say the combination is new, and it has never been done before, and it has utility, and it is not obvious. So we get down to what is the proper approach. And we find that as a conclusion of law, the question of validity is to be determined by the court. But until we come to that final question of validity, there are a number of facts that must be considered. Otherwise, we're deciding it in a vacuum. Now, the 18 points. Number one, the record has established clearly that there was a need for this invention, that the need existed for a long, long time. At one time, the liquid was dispensed with a hand sprayer, a tin hand sprayer. Later on, the sprayer, the plastic sprayer, was hung on the side of the bottle through a cardboard holder. What was needed was a shipper sprayer, a sprayer that could become an integral part of the package and would not leak, it would not break, it would not become lost or pilfered. Kalmar and his customers knew of that need. Number two, we had a problem. The record establishes the fact that the problem was baffling. The petitioners say, supposedly there was a problem, but their own witnesses have admitted over and over again that they could not solve the problem. The problem was that you can't simply place the sprayer inside the container and let it go at that, because it'll leak and it'll get broken. Hanging it on the side was not the solution. It had to do five things. It had to hold the sprayer depressed. It had to house and protect the head against damage. It had to prevent leakage to the outside and onto the label. It had to remain sealed after it had been once sealed at the factory. At the time the sprayer is made, in this condition, the cover cap is sealed in place, and then it can be subsequently placed in the container, and the container cap, the metal container cap, can be sealed through automatic machinery without disturbing the seal between the cover cap and the cock. Those are the things that Mr. Scoggin had to solve. Those are the problems. Point number three relates to the skill and the experience. This court has said many times that if no one has been trying to solve this problem, if this is what we call a wouldn't it be nice invention, and we have many of those, people come in daily and say, wouldn't it be nice if we had this, wouldn't it be nice if we had something else, that is not what we have here. We have the skill and the experience of Kalmar, who had been a leader in the industry in making sprayers long before this invention. They knew what they were doing, and yet they couldn't solve the problem. They had many engineers on their staffs. They had many inventors who had previously invented and obtained patents.
Was that Kalmar's sole business, or was it engaged in the business of selling the fluid in the bottle?
No. Kalmar was initially formed for the purpose of making plastic sprayers, and then they went on...
Plastic what?
Plastic sprayers of the type that preceded this invention without the cover cap, the ordinary sprayer. And then ultimately they were acquired by the Drackett Company, and the Drackett Company, of course, makes many liquid products and uses this sprayer in it. Number four, I term the begging for an answer. Now this is where I cannot find any decisions by this court saying that this is a factor to be considered in determining whether or not an invention is patentable, in determining whether or not the invention was obvious or non-obvious. But we did have urgent pleas to Kalmar by its customers, including Cook, the respondent in this case, for many, many years for the answer. Over and over again, Cook says, will you please come up with something that can be used as a shipper's sprayer that will not leak and will not break.
And would not what?
Would not break. Would not break.
Leak or break?
Break the sprayer. Because hanging it on the side, we had the breakage problems. If you tried to merely put it in the top of the container, it obviously would break in shipment long before it ever got to the housewife. Number five, I termed the struggles. Now, the struggles.
Pardon me. What about the Slosin? Why wasn't that?
As I heard here this morning, that's a good question. And the answer is this. Loshi was on the market in about 1940 for a few months, and a few thousand of their sprayers was actually produced and sold. Then the product came off the market. Now why? The evidence doesn't show. So far as the Loshi people themselves concerned, they don't say why they ceased.
So why was Kalmar searching so hard for something else if that is
That's our
trick?
Point. That's our point exactly. If Loshi is so good...
Well, I don't see that helps you, does it? If Loshi's is really dispositive prior art, what difference does it make that Kalmar didn't make use of it and tried to find something else of its own?
The point that we make is that if Loesch is so good, and if Loesch anticipates our invention, and if Loesch will do the job, why do they infringe? Why did they copy us? Why do they come up with a dead ringer, as the courts below have said?
Well, why did you...
And the answer...
Why did your man go to work and do something of his own if Loesch had already solved it?
Because Loesch would not solve the problem.
Well,
and the reason
what
Loesch
was wrong with it?
That Loesch would not solve a problem, and the testimony shows that you cannot seal effectively on top of the metal container cap for several reasons. Number one, the gasket that must be used becomes absorbed with the material and it'll soon leak. Number two, these container caps are not uniform. They're not perfectly smooth on top. You can never get a solid seal. And number three, when you attempt to use Loesch and put it into a container and use automatic capping machinery, you break the seal that he attempted to establish in the first place. That is why Kalmar did not use Loesch. That is why they are not using it today. And that is why Scotland...
Well, it didn't work.
It would not work.
It didn't solve the leakage problem for one thing.
Right. would not solve the leakage problem, would not permit you to use automatic machinery and putting the sprayers in place, and it would break the seal if you tried it. Now that is what the evidence shows, and to say that that it would work is contrary to what the findings of the two lower courts.
Is there an actual finding about Loci and the...
There is a finding
in the lower court.
Yes, there is a finding in the court below to the effect that Loesch, they did consider Loesch, and they determined that Loesch was not successful, had not been on the market. That it, the lower court indicated, the district court indicated that he recognized that Loesch had been used, but it had been some 25 years ago and had come off of the market, and he recognized the testimony of the experts. Mr. Scoggin himself, to the effect that it would not work, and he enumerated the reasons why it would not work.
Is that finding to which you refer part of the court's opinion? I just wanted to look at it. If it don't won't bother you, if it bothers you, I'll find it.
It's not set out as a specific finding. No, it's all part of the opinion. It's all
part of the trial court,
right? I mentioned as number five the struggles that the parties had in attempting to come up with an answer. Device after device was tried by Kalmar. Suggestion after suggestion was either tried or submitted. They all failed. With respect to the failures, many futile attempts were made to fill the need. The president of Kalmar and the vice president of Drackett testified that he had sad and grievous experiences in trying to solve the problem. At the time the Scoggin invention came on the market, they were still trying to perfect an old leaker called the LP25. S.C. Johnson tried to solve their problems for them, and they put a cellulose cap on top of the LP25 to keep it from leaking. That was not satisfactory. In other words, they were galled by frustration and disappointment, and this court has heretofore indicated that that is one factor to be considered when determining whether or not a patent is valid and whether or not it is obvious. This court is also...
In your statement, I just you consider the most valuable part of the leakage problem. That they solved that.
Yes, yes, and I don't know that there is any one most valuable. The leakage problem, yes. The lack of breakage, number two.
Lack of what?
Breakage, preventing breakage.
Leakage and breakage.
Yes, and then number three, making it possible to put this on the bottle at the bottling factory in a way that when you attach the metal cap, you do not disturb the seal between the cover cap and the collar inside. Above the cover. Counsel said this was a thing. I have compassion for him here too. It's called a rib. It's a part of the cap inside. It's a rib that cooperates with the shoulder on the collar, and that affects the seal. And that seal must be there. It cannot be down below on the metal cap, like in Loesch, because if it is, you have leakage, you break your seal, the gasket will absorb the moisture, it just won't work, and that is why it has not been adopted by Kalmar or by Cook. So we must consider the fact that Baxter Scoggin did come up with the solution. And this court again has said, if we can find that the problem was really licked, and this is a solution to the problem, that must be considered in determining whether or not the invention was obvious and patentable. We must consider the results of this solution. This has opened up many, many new fields. In the Kuno case, in the Kuno versus automatic case, it was pointed out that the result was old. And that was one factor considered by this court in determining that the invention was not patentable. In our case, we have just the opposite. The results are new. It's It's not only used on insecticides, it's used on virtually every liquid. It's branched out into the field of window cleaners and hairsprays and polishes and veterinary products, chemicals of all kinds and medicines. Number 9, the manner of arriving at the solution. The petitioners have vacillated, in our opinion, as to what is the invention. We have defined the invention. We defined it 3 times in our brief. It was adopted by the courts below, and our petitioners say that we are doing a very fine job of defining the invention, and yet they vacillate. They try to say the invention relies in the seal, a particular type of seal. It relies in a space. It lies in 1 or 2 or 3 other things. The invention does not lie in any one thing. The seal is old, the space is old, the cap is old, each individual element is old. Space between the cover cap, the space between the cover cap and... It's on the infringing structure above the black line, which is the cover cap. That space, of course, must be if you're going to establish a seal, but that is what... If you screw all the way down and hit the cover cap of the container cap first, then you don't have a seal. That's quite obvious. It wasn't new. It wasn't claimed to be new. Now, the manner of the solution is number 9 as a point, number 10, the fact that the patent office did issue the patent. There is a presumption of validity. It is now statutorily set forth. Number 11, we have a new combination. The elements of some of themselves are old. That is quite permissible in law. We have the prior art to consider, and the prior art does not anticipate us. All of the pertinent prior art was considered by the patent office except Livingstone, and all Livingstone does is cumulative of a particular type of seal. We do not invent a new seal. We've got to consider number 13, the utility of the device. It does have utility. 100 complaints out of some 15 million. It was not perfect, but it was nearly perfect. The law requires much less. Number 14, we have acceptance. The product has been accepted not only by the public, but it has been accepted by our adversaries in the fact that they copied. Number 14, it has been recognized. Both claims. There are 2 claims. In the record, I wrote it down here a little while ago. There are 2 claims. 512. 512. I've covered the acceptance, the recognition, the fact that the invention has been directly and exactly copied. The Kalmar people sought the same invention, same protection. When they filed their own application, they cited Loesch in their application. They attempted to persuade the patent office that they could get a claim allowed the same as ours over and above Loesch. These are all things that have heretofore been considered by this court as being important. Number 18, and the last, is the fact that there have been successes by both parties. Our petitioners have said initially that the only reason that this patent was held valid was because of the tremendous success. That is not true. I have listed 17 other reasons before I ever came to the question of whether or not it was successful. And then in the reply brief, they apparently realize that they have built up commercial success too much, whereas commercial success became important to show utility, and they now call it a commercial innovation. I don't know why the change, but to me, a commercial innovation is synonymous with commercial novelty. So if they are now saying and admitting that we have something novel, then the only question that remains for this court to determine is whether or not The Eighth Circuit was incorrect in applying the high standards of this court and determining that there were factors, 18 factors, for at long last finding one valid.
May I ask you this question? Stabs me a little. You give 18 guideposts, which may be all relevant. But does that not indicate to some extent that it's impossible to capture one single formula in a short series of words that will allow us to say this is it? Isn't it something like negligence?
I agree with Your Honor in saying that you cannot define obviousness or non-obviousness by one word, yes. So what must we do? We must look to see whether or not there are 18 points or 5 points or 2 points or none. If there are none and there is a doubt, certainly then it becomes a problem on the part of the patentee to try to sustain his patent. But I'm not saying that the absence of all of these 18 points would mean that there would automatically be no invention. I'm not saying that at all. I'm merely saying that when the question is close, the lower courts would like to see this court set down the boundaries so that they can understand. I'm sure they want to follow the A&P case, the Kuno case, and say that we have a high standard of invention. They want to follow that. But what they say whenever the AMP case is cited, they say, oh, well, that's fine. That was an easy one. Obviously, that was unpatentable. Anybody would say that. That's what's happened over and over again, but the Eighth Circuit doesn't say that.
Isn't that just about as definite? Isn't it a matter of judgment, after all, on what you've said, considering all these and maybe 18 more or 36 more facts?
In the final analysis,
it actually reaches the standard, which is frankly impossible of definition.
It is impossible of definition, except that we do have these guidelines. We need these guidelines. If we cast them aside and say they're of no value, then we are hopelessly lost. And the various circuits throughout the land, except for the Eighth Circuit, if there has been a getting away from the high standards, it has been because of the fact that the rest of the circuits, in our opinion, have not followed what the Eighth Circuit says. When we apply 103, we follow the high standards of this court, and they've done so for 35 years. And this is a perfect example, not because it's simple or complex. Some of the most complex devices can be the most unpatentable. Anybody could solve this problem with something complex and inexpensive. But it takes a genius to do it in such a way that it is marketable, that it is inexpensive, that it'll do the job. The simplicity has no bearing. This is not an atomic bomb. This is not going to help us get to the moon. But it is important that we set down the guidelines so that the courts will understand and that the Eighth Circuit be used as an example of how to solve this problem of what is a patentable invention and what is not.
Mr. Lyons.
May it please the court, just a few words in rebuttal. There appears to be a little confusion as to what the record shows as to the use of the Losi patent. The testimony as to the practice under the Losi patent back in the late 30s appears at the record at approximately page 287 and 288. And there, the witness, who was associated with the company that practiced the Losi patent, clearly testified that it inhibited the leakage, that it was capable of an automatic assembly. In other words, that you could put the overcap and the sprayer and the container cap together and then put them into a bottle, which was exactly what Mr. Scoggin did. Now, Mr. Scoggin's testimony was that when he tried the Losi technique, there was leakage. Now, perhaps Mr. Scoggin had some sort of problem that his device helped him to solve, but the fact of the matter is that the Losi, according to the undisputed testimony of what happened back in the late 30s, was an effective commercial device.
Then about the findings of fact at page 26 of the record. Was that a finding of the trial court?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that there is a fact-finding involved in that, I would think it's clearly erroneous on the basis of this record.
Well, it's rather flat, isn't it, that the Losi's cap would not solve the problem that was faced by the manufacturers and sellers of insecticide. And then the concluding sentence of the next paragraph, this form of contact between the end of the hold-down cap and the top of the container would not solve the problem of leakage. You say there's no support in the record for that.
There's no support in the record as to Losi's device. The record is unambiguous that Losi's device was leak-proof back in 1938. That Losi's device, as practiced by his assignee, was leak-proof.
And would you give me those record
references? That starts around 287 in the first volume. In any event, the further contention is, of course, that simply using the seal taught by Livingstone and taught by Mellon, which is all that Scoggin did, was not invention. The prior teachings of this court in the A&P case, in the Marconi wireless case, where the patent issued to the great Marconi was held invalid for want of invention, all indicate that the dominant concern is the prior art, because it is the prior art that people are to be free to draw from to find solutions to their problems. It is not 1/18th of the question. It is the dominant question, as this Court's decisions teach.
Mr. Lyons, it isn't fatal to your case whether Losi solved the leak problem or not.
Certainly not.
Thank you.